Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloen. One of the truly special places in California, and indeed on the planet, is the Angelo Coast Range Reserve in Mendocino County. Located between Highway 101 and the Pacific Coast Highway 1, the 8,000-acre reserve is an incredibly intact variety of coastal ecosystems ranging from about 1,200 to 4,000 feet in elevation, and it includes natural river, riparian corridors, wetlands, forests, meadows, and chaparral. It contains parts of the Eel River and Elder Creek, home to a variety of species including salmonids like trout, salmon, and steelhead. Later on in the show, we'll hear from a married couple who also happen to be UC Berkeley scientists who have used the Angelo Coast Range Reserve for decades. Mary Power is a food web ecologist and the reserve's faculty director. Her husband, William Dietrich, is a geomorphologist from UC Berkeley doing pioneering work there in the storage and transport of water in the Coast Range rocks. But first, our guest is Peter Steele. Peter is the grandson of Heath and Marjorie Angelo. The couple moved to a homestead on the land in 1931, and after decades of maintaining a mostly intact landscape, they deeded their land to the Nature Conservancy, the first ever west of the Mississippi, in 1959. It was later transferred to be a part of the UC Natural Reserve System in 1994. Peter joins us now from the reserve, where he lives in the same location as his grandparents before him. Peter Steele, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
First question for you, how long have you had this gig? Because it's pretty cool.
Well, I've lived here since almost 40 years. I moved up here in July of 1984. When I first moved up here, it was still a Nature Conservancy preserve, and I worked for them on a part-time basis. And then the Nature Conservancy and the university entered into a management agreement in 1989, at which time I changed hats, put on a university hat, and continued on. And I've been stewarding and managing the site since February of 1989.
Well, this reserve has a really fascinating and rich history. Heading back thousands of years, you know, the Native Americans, indigenous people, many tribes used this area.
That's true. As with almost the entire state of California, there were dozens and dozens and dozens of tribes. Mendocino County, I can't remember how many different tribes were in this county, Pomo being a principal tribe. The local tribe that utilized this site was the Caddo people. Their main village area was centered just right outside of Laytonville in the valley where Laytonville is now. But I believe they had, you know, little sister satellite villages scattered around the county in the area.
And then going forward in history, let's talk a bit about the original homesteaders that came through there, because their stories are pretty fascinating. Tell us about the elders, for example.
So you're probably referring to the Elder family. Elder Creek is named after them. They were one of the first, you know, European settlers to file a claim on a homestead here. That would have been, I
think it was like 1880s.
Yeah, it would have been late 1880s, early 1890s. John Walker was kind of the original European settler to sort of explore the area, and he kind of was scouting out areas for the tan bark industry, which was kind of predated the logging industry. And in doing so, he would notice ideal sites for a homestead. And he kind of served as a homestead agent to for some of the people he knew. And he would say, hey, you know, there's this nice spot out in Branscombe. You ought to go check it out. And so the elders did that and filed a claim and set up a homestead.
And then, okay, let's talk about the Angelos, because it's named for them. Tell us about Heath and Marjorie Angelo and how they came there and then how they decided to transfer the property originally to the Nature Conservancy.
Yeah, so Heath and Marjorie Angelo, they're my grandparents, if you weren't going to get to that.
Really? I did not know that. They were your grandparents. So you live on your grandparents' land?
I do, yeah.
Wow.
My mother was raised here. So my grandfather, his parents divorced when he was a young boy, maybe 8 or 9 or 10, somewhere in that age range. And as part of the divorce settlement back then, his father agreed to either put his son, Heath, through college or give him a half interest in the business that he had started after the quake and fire of 1906. He started a box and basket company because people were homeless and needed containers to put things in. So that was a successful business. And my grandfather went to 1 year of college at Berkeley and then decided he needed to take his interest in the business to support his mother and build up his business career. He really wasn't cut out to be a student. So he did that. And in the process of running that business, you know, he had to go and source materials for the building of those boxes and baskets. So he would travel up the Pacific Northwest up into Oregon and Washington and really got to know a lot of the country and had already, you know, known from a time he was a young boy that he really liked the rural lifestyle. And in scouting out sourcing materials for the business, he kind of knew of Mendocino County. And when he got to be about just before age 40, he kind of was planning on retiring. So he and my grandmother, Marjorie, took some camping trips to this area and also up into the foothills of the Sierra to scout out places they might want to settle. So they chose the Branscombe area because it was a little warmer and a little less snow than up in the foothills of the Sierra. And they camped in the campground behind the Branscombe Hotel and scouted out property. And after they left after that camping trip, they put a down payment on 160 acres, which was their original purchase. That would have been about 1930. And then there was a vacant cabin on the property that it was boarded up. And then my grandfather and a couple of friends came up and stayed up here for a few months and got it fixed up and ready to receive my grandmother and their kids, my mother and my uncle. And they moved up here in about 1931 and remained here until their deaths.
And they purchased additional land adjacent to their original place, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. So they moved here in 31, and over the ensuing 25 years, they kept buying parcels as they became available. I don't recall if I was ever told the intimate details of that motivation to do that and amass that amount of land, but they eventually amassed almost 3,000 acres of land. And also during that ensuing 25 years, you know, taxes kept going up and up and up as they tend to do, and particularly on the timber, the value of the timber on their property. And you used to be timber owners used to be taxed for the value of their timber every year, whether they cut it or not. So the taxes got to be so high by the early 50s that they were in danger of either having to log their property, which they didn't want to do, or have to sell it, or both, which a lot of people did. But they didn't want to do that. They didn't want to live in a landscape that was devastated by the logging practices of the time, which were pretty brutal. So they first approached the University of California at their forestry department with the idea of maybe establishing an experimental forest, but that didn't work out. I don't know the details of why that didn't work out, but someone who was peripherally involved in those discussions knew of the Nature Conservancy, and the Nature Conservancy was a relatively new organization. It had only been in existence at that point for about 5 years, and it got started back in New York State. But they were looking to expand their operations across the United States. And so this person connected the Nature Conservancy with my grandparents, and they sold the property for the value of the raw land minus the value of the trees, which were the biggest percentage of the value, and they took a tax write-off. They were able to take a tax write-off on that unrealized income that they didn't get from agreeing to not log their trees. And they also retained a life estate so that they could live on the property, you know, for their lifetime. And they retained that same, they negotiated that same life estate for their kids and their grandkids. So my mother and my uncles and myself and my sisters and cousins, who were all alive at the time, have that same use right.
You literally have deep roots there.
Yeah, I definitely do.
Well, that the transfer to the Nature Conservancy, and from my understanding, this was the first Nature Conservancy property west of the Mississippi.
Correct.
Which makes it a very historic natural reserve, and just from that aspect, and one of the largest for a very long time.
Yeah.
And that happened in 1959, which is the year I was born. So that makes me feel like kind of a special connection to that place. I love that area.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful area, very beautiful site. And it was a significant move for the Nature Conservancy. It was their biggest project that they'd done acreage-wise at that time. And it was a wonderful thing for my grandparents to do, of course. It's a gorgeous place. My grandmother was a lifetime member of the Sierra Club at that point. And my grandfather was kind of a, you know, Teddy Roosevelt kind of a guy. And yeah, so it was a beautiful thing they did.
Well, and then in 1994, it becomes part of the UC Natural Reserve System, which is currently their managers. But let's talk about that natural area. Tell us about what it's like there for people that have never been to this part of the state. It's located basically between 101 and Westport, the north part of Mendocino Coast. Tell us about what it's like there.
It's a, you know, steep, rugged landscape dominated by Douglas fir and redwood, a lot of, you know, heavily vegetated hill slopes. The South Fork of the Eel River runs through the property, you know, supports, you know, salmon and steelhead. You know, it's a largely untouched landscape. The homesteaders did a little bit of logging, but not on a commercial scale. It was mostly for their own personal use. They did cut a few trees to sell to, for grape steaks and fence posts and railroad ties, that sort of thing. But it's largely an intact landscape, very gorgeous, full complement of all the organisms that you might find here. There's mountain lion, black bear, river otter, mink, Pacific giant salamanders, you know, you name it. It's if it's supposed to be here, it is here.
Tell us a bit about some of the different kinds of places there are there, because there's so much variety on that property.
Yeah, well, the river corridor provides, you know, sort of one type of habitat and with all the associated plants and animals that live along the river corridor. So you got your fish and all your and river otter and mink that inhabit that area. There's a series of meadows that are old river terraces where the river once ran, but has moved away from, downcut and moved away from, but it left meadows. So there's some meadow habitat with the associated assemblage of plants and animals there. And then you higher up on the on the slopes of Black Oak Mountain and some of the higher ridges, the habitat grades up into chaparral and scrub oak species. So, and then the biggest percentage of the landscape is dominated by, you know, mixed evergreen hardwood forest made up of Doug fir, redwood, tan oak, madrone, and three or four oak species. So, you know, a huge range of habitat, a lot of biodiversity, a huge number of plants and animals can be found here.
And of course, it's part of the UC Natural Reserve System, which means it's a place for research and learning. Tell us about the facilities that are there for, you know, the visiting researchers and scientists.
Our facilities are a little different. Most of the reserves in the Natural Reserve System have centralized facilities that are, you know, concentrated in one area. We're a little different, just mainly because of the topography and the lack of or the difficulty of access, and the fact that we're utilizing old buildings that may have originated in the homestead area. So there's some housing and lab facilities and a shop at the entrance area to the reserve. And then as you travel in along the main access road, you come to the area where my grandparents settled, and that's where I live, and I have my shop there. And then beyond that, you travel further down the road and you come to what we call Wilderness Lodge and Fox Creek Lodge. And those are additional individual housing for researchers and students. And also the Fox Creek Lodge is the group facility where classes would stay. And, you know, so we have cabins and individual houses. We have a common dining hall, you know, shower bath facilities, you know, full complement of, we can house about, let's see, 45 or 50 scattered amongst those various facilities.
Well, Peter Steele, a manager for the Angelo Coast Range Reserve and member of the Angelo family, thanks for sharing, you know, your love of this very special place that you truly have deep roots in.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks again to our guest, Peter Steele, caretaker for the UC Berkeley Angelo Coast Range Reserve. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll talk to two of the scientists who have been involved in research at the reserve for decades, Mary Power and Bill Dietrich. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot as we examine a very special place in Northern California, the Angelo Coast Range Reserve in Mendocino County. It's part of the University of California's Natural Reserve System and home to a rich variety of ecosystems from natural rivers and riparian corridors to mixed forests and chaparral. Our next guests are two scientists who have been doing research at Angelo for many years. Mary Power is a food web ecologist and professor in the Department of Integrative Ecology at UC Berkeley. She's also the faculty director for the Angelo Coast Range Reserve. Joining her is her husband, William Dietrich. Bill is a geomorphologist in the UC Berkeley Department of Earth and Planetary Science, who has been doing cutting-edge research on how the landscape at Angelo both holds and transfers water in the complex geology of the Coast Range. Mary Power and Bill Dietrich, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks.
Thanks.
And Mary, I'd like to start with you. Tell us a bit about how long you've been at Angelo Coast Reserve. What was it like when you first came there?
Well, I started in California. Bill and I have been happily married since the mid-70s, really. And I had a lot of trouble with vandalism of field experiments in California. I'd just do small little chambers, like trying to measure photosynthesis of algae or do very small experiments. But as deep as I could get into the national forest, like the Mendocino National Forest, the recreationalists spelled with a W would get in as deep or deeper, and I'd always come back to find my experiments vandalized, trashed. And then a graduate student in forestry at Berkeley told me about this Nature Conservancy Reserve. And so I went there. Peter Steele was their Nature Conservancy steward. We met each other in the late 80s. So I started working there in 87. And over the years, the Nature Conservancy kind of informally handed it off to UC Berkeley, and that became official in 1994. And so for all of these years, I've been the faculty director trying to get the university to support the reserve. And Peter's been the one person there on the ground managing 8,000 acres and the scientific infrastructure that Bill and I have managed to get funded through grants and donations. So it became a bigger and bigger job for all three of us.
And Bill, let's start talking about your work there, because you come at the reserve from the perspective of a geomorphologist, a geology perspective. Tell us about some of the things there that make it such a unique and special place to study.
I would say there are a number of factors, one of which is that it's an area that's tectonically active. So it's undergone actually fairly recent uplift. If you were standing at the reserve 4 million years ago, you'd be underwater.
Wow.
Yeah.
In geologic terms, that's pretty short.
It's nothing. Yeah. And you'd be standing on marine, you know, sediments deposited in the ocean. As the San Andreas Fault propagated northward through Northern California, it did this kind of snakehead pulse of uplift, and it just propagated past where the Angelo Reserve is about 4 million years ago. And so suddenly these marine sediments came out of the water, formed a steep landscape, and water ran off. And rivers went to work, cutting canyons, cutting a network of channels. So small ones go to bigger ones, go to the biggest one, becoming the Eagle River system, which fights for drainage with the Russian River, which is going the opposite direction. And so you have this very dynamic landscape. And it was the pulse has passed on through. And so you have a landscape that's not going up as fast, but sending little signals of elevation change from the mouth, which is going up much faster at, than where the Angelo Reserve is, the mouth of the Yellow River. And what that leads to is a very interesting landscape. Rivers cutting down create hill slopes. That's what lies between rivers. And the hill slopes tend to steepen up in response to river incision and tend to erode at the rate the rivers cut down. And if the slopes are steep enough on these recently uplifted marine sediments, you get landslides. And so much of the landscape in the Angelo Coast Range Reserve, but actually in the Yellow River itself as a whole, is etched and dominated by large and small landslides that have left a topographic fingerprint all over the landscape. And in that context, the appeal to us in that when I started working there in the late 80s, when Mary did, and with my graduate student groups, was to ask the question, what controls the pace of river incision into these landscapes? Could we predict the rate of incision and the processes themselves? And so our earlier work was to identify the basic processes. We did experiments and then modeling to as the field site served as a motivation and a testing site for ideas.
What's the elevation at Angelo Coast Reserve since it was underwater 4 million years ago, which again is a blink of the eye geologically?
It's on the scale, Mary might remember too. It's
Caddo Peak, which is just east of the reserve, is I think about 2,200 feet high. But
I've got it in meters, which is why I hesitated. It's about 450 meters at the floor. So I was trying to remember it. So at this stage, like 1,500 feet is the channel bottom, and then it rises up to maybe, you know, approaching 1,800 feet, something like that.
Okay, let's talk about your work there, Mary. You've done some fascinating work on algae mats there, and it's really interesting to me to look at the role of climate and climate change with your work. Let's talk a little bit about what happens seasonally in years there, because it's going to be very different. As we know in California, you can have these years of lots of flooding and, you know, heavy water years like we've had this last 2 years, or you can go through these cycles of very dry years.
Okay, so I'll start just saying that as a food web ecologist, I get to play with all the members of the food web that I want. And it goes from like algae and some microbes up through now the salmonids and the pike minnow that are eating the salmonids, and other places I've also worked on fishing birds. So the whole food web is reset by these different water years that you're describing. And I think for starters, we can think of them in four categories: two winter flow regimes and two summer flow regimes. So as you were saying, we get rainy winters some years, and if there are peak floods that are enough to fill the entire low flow, base flow channel, then the bed moves and you get a severe scour event. So if you're thinking of algae and algae grazers and the rock-bound biology, during those flow events, everybody is churned into, you know, dead organic matter exported out to the Pacific, or there's a lot of death and displacement there. So I get students to try to think of some nice pasture in Sonoma, and the whole, and suddenly it erupts and all the Holsteins are ground into hamburger. You know, that's what it's like. It's very devastating for the rock-bound biology, but anything big and mobile like a fish is swimming above it. And so then that resets the food web for the following summer. So that's our winter. If you get a summer that follows that, then for the first weeks of May into early June, the algae are growing pretty uninhibited because a lot of the big grazers have been scoured away and they can get meters long. So people notice big algal blooms following one at least one scouring flood the previous winter. But then that will change color, and we could talk about the algal succession, why Rapunzel's long green hair turns into a blonde and then a redhead over the summer, and that's increasing layers of nutritious diatoms. So that starts, and then following the scouring winter floods, you get long food chains that guide energy and nutrients to fish, and it's a good fish year. So we can call that a salmon year. And then if you lack those floods, then large numbers of armored caddisflies and other defended grazers survive the winter. And by early summer, when the days are getting longer and the flow's clearing up, the algae start to bloom, but they get nibbled back immediately by 10 to 100 times higher densities of large armored caddisflies. And a common one is about the size of a cigarette butt. It's Dicosmicus. It's actually one of the world's largest armored caddisflies. And they're too big for most of the fish in our upper South Fork to eat, where we just have minnows and juvenile salmonids. So that becomes, it goes from like a 3 or 4 link food chain topped by happy salmon to a 2 link food chain where most of the energy is getting diverted into armored grazers or sessile grazers, slow growing predator resistant grazers who weren't knocked back. And then the salmon are still there, but they don't feed as well and they don't grow as fast. So you want that scour. There are a lot of reasons that fish managers and ecologists and people who like salmon want a stream bed to scour. It cleanses the spawning sediments. Some often operates to disfavor invasive native species, especially if they came from the Midwest, like bullfrogs, the non-natives. But in addition, it resets the food web to a state that better feeds fish because of more edible bugs. Okay, so now you've heard two states, the flow scour in winter or lack of flow scour, but both states were followed by summer recession that didn't get so low that the river becomes stressed. And so now I want you to think about the two summer flows we can have. One is adequate base flow to get the salmon through their early life histories, get them out if they're going to out-migrate, and keep the nutritious algae cool and flushed and happy. That's a summer with adequate base flow, but more and more because of a bunch of reasons, but some relate to drought, some relate to human water extraction in the summer, over-extracting for marijuana, for example. There's hypotheses, which Bill can speak to, relate to the changes in the forest that locals call Doug furification, too many young Doug fir growing up and evapotranspiring away summer water. But Bill has thoughts and observations on that. And then also when the eel was degraded by the big floods that followed the rapacious logging, so the 55 and 64, 65 floods, it got wide and shallow and there were poorly engineered roads that just bled sediments in. So as you probably know, the eel is wider and more enriched in deposited sediment than it should be. So the flow could just underground. So there are four reasons that we have sometimes troublingly low summer flows. And any of those that get the water warmer than like a lukewarm bath, like 25 degrees C, and let large parts of the mainstem sunlit pools, let large parts stagnate, then picture the bottom of the food web. The algae is regrown, but the nutritious algae gets overgrown with toxic cyanobacteria. So that's when you start to see these flecks of blue-green that kind of coalesce and they make rusty brown diatom-covered turfs that are nutritious into toxic cyanobacterial spires that if these things are feeding on the rotting algae that they've overgrown, almost like a parasite or a predator, and then they pop loose and float downstream and accumulate in the wrong backwater where the dog runs through and licks its fur and dies in convulsions. So that's, if you have that, the four food web states, then that would be the worst case. The worst case is actually a nice flushing flow in the winter that's followed by severe summer drought, maybe by too much water extraction in the summer, that produces a lot of algae that then gets overgrown by a lot of cyanobacteria.
There's good algae and bad algae.
Yeah, most of the algae are good, and they're only and they're only noticed when they're bad. So it's very unfair to the algae.
well, you made a. I read something that you said that I never considered, and I thought it was great. I wish you'd comment and explain it. That the diatoms are so nutritious for fish, and that we say, oh, you know, fish have a fishy smell. And you said something to the effect that, no, it's like fish have a diatommy smell.
Yeah,
could you explain that?
Sure. It's actually a quote from my algal guru, a wonderful man who teaches out of the Midwest, but he's educated me, and some of my PhDs were his master's students. So Jane Mark. So this is Rex Lau. I have to give him credit. He said, diatoms don't smell fishy. Fish smell diatommy. And it's just because the diatoms, most diatoms, there's only one toxic diatom. We have problems with our crab fishery because of a marine diatom that causes the brown tides. But most diatoms are really gifts to the food web because they are very digestible and they're full of lipids and carotenoids. So especially polyunsaturated fatty acids, which we and all animals need for their nerve health, their membrane health of our cells, they're fundamental, and we require them, and we have to get them from our diets because we can't make them. So those are made by diatoms and a few other golden brown algae. And then the diatom also, they have their orange and yellow colors because of carotenoids, which are vitamin A, like carrots. they're also essential nutrients for animals. And then a third thing that's very special about the diatom that for some strange reason becomes the most abundant diatom in the Eel River after about midsummer. And that's a very nutritious algae diatom that's called epithemia, Greek word for desire. And epithemia is a diatom, but it has inside it endosymbionts, a creature that lives inside another creature. In this case, these species fix atmospheric nitrogen. It means they take 80% of the gas out of the atmosphere. They can use N2 gas, and then they reduce it to first ammonia, but then they synthesize all 23 essential amino acids that animals need. So it's a superfood, and yet it becomes really abundant. And I would not predict that as an ecologist. If you're highly delicious and nutritious, you generally are grazed down.
Ah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, we're profiling the scientific work being done at UC Berkeley's Angelo Coast Range Reserve, which is part of the UC Natural Reserve System and located in Mendocino County. Our guests are two of the scientists who have worked there for decades, ecologist Mary Power and geologist Bill Dietrich. We're going to take a brief break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with UC Berkeley food web ecologist Mary Power and her husband, UCB geomorphologist Bill Dietrich, as we talk about their research work at Angelo Coast Range Reserve, part of the UC Natural Reserve System, located in Mendocino County. Let's talk a bit about the hydrology of what's going on there with the Eel River and the watershed in general. Talk about some of the tools that you've used over the years. One of the things I saw is that, you know, to get a handle on the topography there, you started to use LIDAR to really understand what was going on with the landscape. Could you address that a little bit?
Sure. So LIDAR is a means of surveying that relies on sending a laser out and getting a return. You know the speed of light. And so if you know your elevation and position well, you know the distance from the returning surface. So this is actually used in planes. And to then use the satellite system for being able to locate a plane accurately in space and know its precise location and elevation, and that becomes a platform from which the laser shoots down to the surface. And so you send a scanning pulse of light down, and it returns off whatever it hits, and that includes trees, ground, houses, whatever it encounters. And so what we get then is something like 10 centimeters. So it's like 3-inch vertical resolution imagery of the landscape, which, and therefore we can document the structure of trees, we can document very accurately the topography of the landscape. And for us geomorphologists, the suddenly being able to see landscape at the scale of a few feet elevation variation in space is equivalent to someone who's had really bad vision all their lives. And it's fun for the first time getting a pair of glasses. You can actually see the landscape at the scale at which processes operate. And so that gave us the ability to actually see what I mentioned before, that the landscape in the Angela Coast Main Reserve and across the Eel River is dominated by the legacy or active landslides that are shaping the landscape, which we could not see before because in aerial photographs, the trees were in the way, and the earlier attempts to make topographic map, as impressive as they were too coarse to see the actual topography. And with that then in hand, we can then begin to identify the structure of the landscape that then could be influencing the delivery of water.
Well, and one of the things you mentioned that that I've noticed in hiking around that region is how ubiquitous and important landslides are. Could you talk a bit about the role that they play in the process of the hydrology and what goes on with that river system?
Okay, the landslides essentially shape the landscape by leading to large areas that are irregularly deformed because you're, say, dealing with a landslide that could be a kilometer across and 100 meters deep. But there's also shallow landslides that involve usually just a soil mantle, and they tend to scour troughs into the hillside, so you get small gullies and things like that. And overall, the role of landsliding is the consequences it provides the loading of sediment into the river, which then does the work that Mary talked about in terms of mobilizing her critters and sending sediment out to the ocean. Now, in terms of hydrology, it can be a complicating factor because, you know, you can imagine a disorganized landmass of displaced material. The groundwater that develops in there can be quite complicated. But if we take a step back, we still see a simplicity or a simplifying approach to looking at the world, which is to use this term hill slope, which we mean the landmass between the channels, and to think about how the water moves through the hill slope. So if I could put it this way, in essence, a landscape is composed of hill slopes bounded by channels, and the vast majority of the rainfall lands on the hill slopes and then makes its way to the channel. And the key to understanding both the hydrology of the stream and the vegetation and the environment is to figure out that water path and, importantly, the storage of subsurface water.
What are the rock types there and how do they affect this? Because I know you've got hard rock there and some very soft rock. Could you talk a bit about the different rock types, like the mudstones and the sandstones?
Yeah, so these are the bedrock is a deposits of underwater landslides, very fine mud that's settled out over slow time in the ocean floor. And then the sediments have been buried by more than a mile of other rocks, therefore become consolidated and made into harder material. And then the specific marine sediments were shoved on shore. And in that process, they get pretty broken. And then Northern California is broken into distinct belts of rock that have undergone different levels of deformation. Along the coast, the least altered, least broken rock called the coastal belt is composed primarily of sandstones and shale. Shale is just silt and clay-sized particles. The particles too small to see by the naked eye, whereas sand is something you can see by the naked eye. And they have very different behaviors. The sandstone tends to be stiff and be resistant to erosion and when it breaks, forms large blocks. And so the sandstones in the Angelo area are composed about 30% of the landscape, and there are distinct bedding and layers that are fairly narrow. Most of the landscape is composed of the shale, and the shale is being kind of, if you like, fine grain and clay and bearing and clay mineral bearing deforms in a what we call a ductile way. It shears it deforms around the sandstone and it breaks into lots of very fine fractures in the near surface environment, breaks into kind of fingernail size gray particles. The consequence of that is that the shale, which is when it's fresh, is the least permeable rock on the planet practically. When it gets in the near surface environment and weathers and breaks, it becomes a sponge and it completely changes the hydrology. And it's that spongy behavior that turns the Elder Creek, the primary creek in Angela Reserve, into a what we call a water store environment, where significant fractions of the annual rainfall is held within the hillslope and then released slowly, doing two things: providing stream flow to the river that Mary then studies, and critically, plant available water for the forest.
Well, Mary, you two are married, and you both work in the same place at Angelo Coast Range Reserve. I'm just curious, how does some of Bill's work inform what you do?
For example, I think Bill should be the one to tell you more about this, but he referred to the coastal belt mudstones or shales as being a water storing watershed. But his students and he have studied the melange areas. And we have a friend who has a ranch right where you see the savanna and the deciduous oaks take over the landscape. That's in the central belt, where the shale is ground up more. So it's very clay rich and very impermeable. And those are watershed landscapes. So we make a verbal distinction. This it's not an official scientific term, but water storing versus water shedding landscapes. And so it's very interesting to think about what the fate of fish are in these two environments, because in the Elder Creek, for example, a tributary in a water storing watershed, you have, it's dark, it's cool, and maybe it's heavily shaded because the forest is grown up, and the fish are growing, but not that fast in March, April, May, after they emerge, that year's cohort emerges. But they get a long time to grow because it's going to be a permanent stream. So if they want to stay there 2 years, not 1 year, they can be resident for 2 years, or some of them are resident for a long time, the rainbow trout that don't migrate to the ocean. So we have more permanent but slower growth in those cool tributaries. In the contrast, in places in Melange, and this would include the central belt of the Eel, but also a lot of the Russian River, they're watersheds, so life is great in March and April. It's warmer, it's sunny, there's more deciduous vegetation, more disturbance vegetation. It's more edible by the bugs. The bugs are feeding the fish, and by June, those fish are really fat and happy, but by July, they could be dead because the river goes underground. So life histories there should, we hope, have a way of getting back to the main stem and getting out to the ocean, not getting caught in a death trap, which you often see. So several other ecologists, Stephanie Carlson and Gabe Rossi, primarily are studying whether there is a life history diversity so that they can grow in watersheds that are on this shallower reservoir of water that's going to dry up in summer. Can they fatten up and get out, or is it always a death trap? So that's one way that it matters to fish.
I've seen this area referred to as a critical zone, one of many that have been identified. Could you explain what is a critical zone?
Okay, so as we use it, the term originates from a National Academy report in 2000, and it's a term that we use to describe the zone from the top of the forest canopy down to fresh bedrock in these landscapes and down to the active groundwater. So this is so much better done with an illustration, but I'll try to draw one in your mind's eye. So go back to your walking around the landscape and you can look up and see the forest canopy. And now you come down, you see the surface of the earth, but now keep going. and go down until what I described before, where the rocks break, creating holy water, to get down to where the rock hasn't experienced any change as a result of being uplifted, because it hasn't entered the near surface environment sufficiently. And that boundary typically, particularly in the shale, is a hydrologic barrier. The conductivity goes way down. And as a consequence, what happens is when rock enters the near surface environment, physical and chemical processes open up the landscape, and you take a bedrock that could serve as a countertop in your kitchen, and you literally turn it into a sponge. And that's what happens in the Angelo Coast Range Reserve in this shale that I described. And what we've been able to show by putting in a very intensive set of measurements, we're currently right now, we're making observations at about 700 data points every 5 minutes about what the water is doing in the ground and in the air. We can show that the consequence of that alteration of the rock, weathering we call it, as a result of entering the near surface environment, is annually there's about 300 millimeters, which is about, let's say, 10 to 12 inches of water equivalent, that ends up being stored in the weathered rock, much as it is, as most people are familiar with, water gets stored in soils and plants use it. Well, below the soil surface, into the weathered rock, there's also moisture storage, plant available moisture storage, above any groundwater. And what Daniel Arempi and other students work with me have shown is that seasonally, that moisture is exploited by trees and takes out, on an annual basis, about on average on this hillside that we've intensely monitored, during the summer, there's 300 millimeters of water extracted by trees out of just the weathered rock, and only about 60 from the soil. And during that time, there's only about 15 millimeters of equivalent water running out of the system. So most of the water in the system is being pulled out by the trees and sent into the atmosphere, affecting the humidity there and delivering water that ends up being rainfall someplace else. And that then enables an evergreen forest to be in a Mediterranean climate, because it's exploiting a deep storage reservoir of this term what we propose, which is rock moisture. This phenomena of pulling water at great depth and a large amount of water and return to the atmosphere, much more than from the soil, our climate modeler colleague Inez Fung explained to us, is missing in global climate models. It's a phenomena that was kind of anecdotally known about, but this is the first place in the planet where we've quantitatively documented this through multiple years and across a landscape. And so we think this helps explain why, for example, the Angelo Coast Range Reserve had no significant tree death, but in the Sierra, where there was something like 100 million trees died, because it's the difference in how much water is stored in the weathered rock zone. And then to further illustrate this effect, if you stand at Cato Peak and look further east toward Laytonville, there's an abrupt vegetation change that you can see. It goes from a dark green forest to grassland. And that's the transition to this other rock type. That it's interesting, it's the same shale I mentioned, but it's been so ground up, it's literally like toothpaste. And the informal term for it in California is blue goo, and you may have heard that term. And it's a headache for Caltrans, which is always working on trying to deal with these big landslides that are a result of the very mechanically weak rocks that form in the blue goo. But the other thing about the blue goo is, imagine trying to push water through toothpaste. It's not going to happen. So as a consequence, as the rivers cut down there, there's no drainage pulling the water out of the rock. And so it stays very wet, but water very tightly held. And the critical zone to compare at Angelo at the hillside is 100 feet deep and narrows down to about 10 feet toward the channel. And this rock we call melange, and this toothpaste-like material out toward Laytonville, their critical zone is only about 10 feet deep at the maximum.
Wow, that's amazing. Tell us about the value of being able to work at a place like Angelo Coast Range Reserve for you as a scientist and as an educator.
The places like the Angelo Coast Range Reserve are absolutely precious and vital for understanding the future of Earth's ecosystems. And I think both of our opinions and in the opinions of most ecologists and earth scientists who have used them, I feel that Angelo and many of the other UC reserves have really established friendships, real friendships with the local neighbors. And then we become entrained and hopefully of great use, we hope, to environmentalists that are seeking to look out for the future of nature and people in beautiful regions like the North Coast.
I just want to thank you both, Bill Dietrich, from the geology perspective at Angelo Coast Range Reserve. Mary Power, your wonderful perspective on the food webs there and the biology of that place. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our guests, Angelo Coast Range Reserve caretaker Peter Steele, along with UC Berkeley food web ecologist and professor in the Department of Integrative Biology, Mary Power, and Bill Dietrich, a geomorphologist in the UC Berkeley Department of Earth and Planetary Science. You can learn more about their work and Angelo Coast Range Reserve, including information on how you can visit the reserve yourself, at angelo.berkeley.edu. It's one of the most beautiful, diverse, and wild parts of California, and definitely a special place. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.